Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Joe Keating.
And today we've got Professor Lars Hulmer from the University of Uppsala, Sweden, talking to us about brachiopods. So, Joe, brachiopods, have you ever found one?
I have indeed found many, all different shapes and sizes. And as you well know, we found some last weekend while we were out prospecting for field localities. Not that I'm crowbarring this in any way, for Progressive Paleontology, which is a conference for student paleontologists and people interested in evolution from around the country and further afield, which will be in Bristol this April. And registration is now open at www.palas.org.
So if you're a student, make sure you register for that and come and see us in Bristol. Can anyone register that's not a paleontology student? Is it open to members of the public?
It's free. You can come along. It's probably going to be quite technical, but if you're thinking of doing paleontology, you'd like to go to a conference, and you're more than welcome to come along, chat to some young and up and coming paleontologists. Don't bother chatting to me.
And I think it was definitely my first paleontology conference, and I think as someone who's been on the periphery of paleontology academia for so long, I've been to about eight or so of these conferences. I think I win the award for...
I've been to three or four.
But it is really good. It's the kind of place where you can get to practice, like, giving public presentations, if you don't want to do that in front of all of the academic world of professors and whatnot, and just want to do it to your peers.
It is a real conference, that we have prizes for the best scientific talks and posters, but also it's a conference of your immediate peer group, and so you can get feedback and practice giving talks and presenting posters, that kind of thing. And it's good fun. We have a field trip, which we've been organising this last weekend, into Wales, looking for brachiopods, among other things, and also some early fishes, which will keep me happy.
Yep. And we did find some early fishes, didn't we?
We did. I was very excited. I found my very first heterostracon, so I can call myself a real early vertebrate paleontologist now.
So you'd never found one of your own fossils up until that point?
They're very rare, very difficult to find. And there's only a few localities in the country where you can actually find them. But I know what I'm looking for now.
Yep, good.
So brachiopods.
Brachiopods. Something that, yes, I have overlooked.
Yeah, me too. I mean, the problem is that they look quite like shells that you find on the beach today. And so if you don't know any better about their biology or anatomy, it's quite hard to get excited about just these fossil shells. But they're actually really interesting organisms and very different from the shells you'll find on the beach.
As I'm sure you'll all find out. So, as always, please feel free to leave a comment and like and subscribe if you've not yet already done so. And if you've not, where have you been?
Check out our Twitter account. And email us any of your questions or suggestions. We're always really keen to hear from you.
So this is the first part of a two-part interview, so stay tuned for the next episode coming in a few weeks. So Lars, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
As always, with every interviewee we have, could you please start off by telling us how you got into paleontology?
Well, I was always interested in old things. I considered turning into archaeology when I was my early teens. But I got in contact with people at the Natural History Museum in Stockholm. And I turned up with the high school fossil collection, and it all went from there, really.
what did you have in that collection?
Oh,
do you remember?
It was corals from Gotland mostly. I mean, you know, it's if there is a fossil collection, at schools in Sweden, it's bound to include fossil corals from Gotland, because basically you can't avoid finding them on the island. So it's a wonderful Silurian sort of little island in the Baltic with some of the finest Silurian fossils in the world. Actually, the Silurian was proposed to be called the Gotlandium, but it was assassinated by
Murchison.
By Murchison, yes, exactly. Obviously.
I think one day we'll have to do something about the naming of the Silurian system.
Yes.
So, you now research brachiopods. So, what is it that got you into brachiopods opposed to anything else, opposed to corals, opposed to dinosaurs and bigger, more interesting things?
Indeed. I mean, I think it sort of went from... I always had a sort of fancy for dissolving limestones in acid, and I thought of doing conodonts. I did my first year of college in the US together with Gary Webster, who was one of my earliest academic teachers, and he's a conodont expert. So he put me on the Harding sandstone, which is a wonderful Ordovician conodont yielding and actually a fish yielding formation in the US. And I did a little project and I sort of liked doing that. So when I got back, I talked to my mentor at the Riksmuseum, Valde Jonsson, and he suggested that these phosphatic brachiopods that no one had looked at before very much would be a good topic for my thesis. So that's really how I got into brachiopods, from conodonts, really.
All right. And brachiopods are not normally phosphatic, are they?
Well, there are these two groups, or rather three groups today, big groups. And two of those are consist of calcium carbonate, but the third one is phosphatic. So they've always been around. And actually, the earliest known brachiopods are phosphatic. So they've certainly had a continued presence on since the beginning of the Cambrian.
Well, we'll get to that later. But first of all, defining brachiopods, is it all to do with the shell, really? Is that what defines them as a group?
Actually, absolutely. I mean, if you remove the shell, you don't get much left. I mean, they are famously empty of soft parts and also famously inedible. I mean, there is very little energy to be gained from eating brachiopods, and thus very few animals today eat brachiopods. So they are absolutely, completely defined by their shell.
So when you're trying to define a brachiopod species, is it all morphological characters in the shell, what shape it is, where there's a certain rib, where there's a certain hinge line, opposed to anything you can do with like the DNA for modern species?
Well, because sort of 99% of the diversity is gone, we really have only these three remaining groups today. So it's a matter of how these three groups are related to one another, and all of the fossil taxa will have to be sort of placed in that kind of context. But so far, molecular cladograms or trees have been very unstable, and it's still very controversial how those three groups are related, how they, what the topology, what the sort of structure of the brachiopod tree look like. I mean, there are not many not many alternatives, but we can't seem to get the stable topology of the brachiopod tree. So yes, we try to take the molecular framework and then try to place the fossil 99% diversity onto the tree, or that is based on the recent living brachiopods. But I should say, you do get quite a lot of soft anatomy information from the shell, because even though they have very few characters, anatomical characters, I mean, sort of muscles and soft tissue, they do leave an imprint. So we can actually be pretty sure what the musculature of this extinct group looked like, and also how the sort of blood vessels, the circulation system looked like, and so on and so forth. So the few anatomical characters that they have actually very commonly leave an imprint in the hard shell, which makes it possible to get more characters.
So you mentioned that brachiopods are famously inedible, but something that is edible and pretty similar aesthetically is a bivalve. So can you tell us the difference between these two?
Absolutely. And if you start with what you mentioned, the sort of source as food, they are, couldn't be more different. I mean, like I said, brachiopods are, most of them are completely inedible and don't contain much in terms of nutrients anyway. Whereas mussels, of course, are completely the opposite. They are delicious and a very, very important source of food. So they have gone in completely different directions during their evolution. And this sort of low metabolic niche and sort of inedible niche, I think, is one that the brachiopods entered very early. So that's sort of the most obvious difference. You can just try to eat them, and the one that tastes horrible will be a brachiopod. But also their anatomy is different. I mean, they have two shells, but in the case of the bivalves, the mussels, it's a left and right shell, and the anatomic orientation of the brachiopod shell is different. It's a lower and upper shell. Although having said that, this is something that needs to be sort of investigated more from the point of view of DNA, of course, because there are these gene complexes that would be interesting to investigate to see if they support the view that all brachiopod shells are sort of lower and upper rather than right and left. There has been some controversy over that, and it's the jury is still out on that one.
Oh, wow, because that's basically one of the very first things that I learned in paleontology class, was that the line of symmetry between bivalves goes between the valves, and the line of symmetry in brachiopods goes straight through it.
Yeah, but it's more complex than that. I mean, anatomist published result that seemed to indicate that in one of the more obscure, odd groups that are still living, it actually, according to him, had a front and back shell rather than a lower and upper shell. I've actually worked on that organism together with another biologist, and we don't agree with the earlier results, but obviously, again, the jury is still out on that one, but I think that it's more complex than we have suspected. But there is very little to support this front and back shell that has been proposed. I listened to your interview with Jakob Winter, of course, and he is one of them who has, I mean, because it's Halkieria, this very famous Lagerstätten organisms that now seems to be basal mollusk of some sort, and this beast was previously put at the base of the brachiopod tree, and with this supposed embryological information, it was kind of proposed as a model by which brachiopods then would have a front and back shell, but again, very controversial.
And if you want to listen to that episode, it's episode 12 on Paleozoic Problematica. Award-winning episode, of course, which you all knew already. So the ecology of a brachiopod, how does it live? So you said that they were in a pretty low energy environment.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is the take-home message, that I think they very early went into this low energy kind of niche, and they basically stay there. And I think their lack of success in the modern fauna is probably related to them having stayed in that niche that was very favorable in the Paleozoic, but is now a rather more obscure niche, perhaps. So they basically, they are all filter feedings, of course, filter feeding animals. They have a specialized organ, sort of ciliated tentacles that filter the little food that they consume from the water. And most of them are sessile, that is, they sit on a hard substrate. And only one form today is capable of digging in the sediment, and that is the classic living, sort of, it's been called the living fossil, the genus Lingula and Glottidia. They are capable of performing this digging motion, and all the others are epibentic, sort of sitting attached to a hard substrate.
So this filtering device, I think it's called a loafophore, is that correct?
That's right.
So does that stay inside the shell, or do they stick it out of the shell?
Yes, I mean, that is actually why they are called brachypods, is because that means, an arm that is used as a foot. And the early idea was that this loafophore could also be used for locomotion somehow. Now, when they are larval, when they are sort of living as larvae, they may have some sort of movability using the larval loafophore. And I've seen sort of photographs of recent brachypods with the loafophore extending beyond the valve, but I think that is very unusual. I think the majority never ever or even can't extend the loafophore outside of the valve, so it's always kept inside this filtration chamber, as it were.
Okay, and how do they attach to the substrate? Do they cement themselves on?
Yes, one. This weird form, it's been called various things, but most recently it's called Novocrania, and that is because it looks like a little skull. Basically, that's the imprint of the muscles, and that attaches itself completely by the lower valve to the substrate. So it's completely cementing, but that's the only one. In the recent brachypods that do that, all the others have some sort of stalk. And in these lingulids, in Lingula, it's used for digging, but in the majority of the calcareous shelled groups, it's attached firmly to a hard substrate.
Before, we were talking about the phylogenetics, the family relationships of brachiopods, and that we can't work out quite how they're all related, but can we look at brachiopods as a whole group and fit them into a larger scale view of the whole animal tree of life? What's their closest relatives?
Again, a very controversial topic. Before the molecular studies became possible, it was commonly thought that they had some kind of either intermediate position between the two big sort of groupings of animals today, the protostomes and the deuterostomes, and of course we belong to the deuterostomes. So with that view, they were kind of in between, but other systematists have preferred to put them along with the deuterostomes, because it was thought that the way they filter feed and this loafophore had some similarities with some of the basal sort of deuterostome phyla. However, I think that's the only thing that the molecules kind of agree on when it comes to this, is that they seem to be firmly attached to the other big group, the protostomes, and most analyses indicate that they belong together in some kind of group that is variously named, but Lophotrochozoa has been one name, and that is of course formed by the name of the food or the filtering organ, the lophophore, and also a common type of larvae in this group. And in this group also includes the other group you mentioned, I mean the mollusks, the bivalves, and annelids, and a whole range of very odd, small, sort of worm-like phyla. Our great Uppsala scientist Linnaeus, of course, had a grouping for all of these. It's called the vermes. All worm-like organisms were great grouped together by him. But of course, that is not it's supported by by more recent studies. But it's been a long tradition to group these worm-like organisms together.
We first started off by saying that the shell is the most definitive part of a brachiopod. How important is it for this animal? What advantages and disadvantages does it provide?
Indeed. I mean, the way the filter feeding takes place in all of the living taxa, it's actually a prerequisite. They could not, if you remove the shell, they cannot function at all, because the way that the filtration current goes through the lophophore and sort of dividing it into inhalant and exhalant current, that is only possible with the shell. So if you strip it of the shell, not that that is possible, because then, I mean, you know, you also rip the the animal apart. But so it's absolutely essential. It could not function without the shell. And it, of course, provides protection as well. But like I said, I actually dived quite a bit in New Zealand. And I have to say, and studies has also been made of this, it's very rare to find predation marks on recent brachiopods. I remember in the Fiordlands, when I dived there, there were lots of shells with holes in. But actually, when I opened them, they were already dead. And the hole was made by a worm that was actually living inside the dead brachiopod shell. So it doesn't seem to have a very high predation sort of level in the recent groups, at least.
Do you think that's maybe because they're in this low energy environment away from all the predators?
Possibly. I think they've been pushed into this. I mean, because these environments that they live in are usually quite sort of what we call cryptic. I mean, in the Fiordlands in New Zealand, where they perhaps are the most common and have the highest diversity, I mean, that's a very odd environment with almost vertical kind of fjord-like cliffs. With a very specialized fauna living on it, and somehow they seem to go for this odd environments underneath boulders and in caves and things like that. It's probably also related to the fact that they are easily disturbed when they are settling. There's been some experimentation done on this in the Mediterranean, I know, and that seemed to indicate that the larvae is quite easily disturbed by, you know, all this grazing and bulldozing organisms, echinoids and sea stars and grazing mollusks of various types. And that, of course, is a group that has exploded in the modern fauna. So they also may have been pushed into this cryptic or strange habitats by this kind of pressure rather than predation.
You said this place in New Zealand has the highest diversity. How many species of brachiopod actually exist?
Yes, today, I mean, we did the treatise, as I recall, there's about 100 genera of recent brachiopods. And of course, we have the problem of splitting. But I mean, I would say around 200, between 200 and a bit more species. And we have, of course, in contrast, about, I think, 5,000 fossil genera. And again, the number of species is anyone's guess, but, you know, say you know, 15,000 species, perhaps. So it's a big difference. Like I said, most of the diversity has disappeared, unfortunately. It's one of the most tragic events in Earth's history.
So they were a lot more common when they were first around?
Absolutely. I was always thinking of writing the book when brachypods ruled the world, but I doubt anyone would make a movie out of it.
So hopefully this episode has given you a good grasp of brachiopod anatomy, behavior, and life habits. And in the next episode, we'll be focusing a bit more on their evolutionary history.
So stay tuned and we'll see you again next time.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.